The Cozy Earth Mother's Day Sale is here. Their incredible bedding and loungewear is mind-blowingly satisfying to touch, and it is sourced from bamboo, and it's good for the planet, free from toxins, it gets softer with every single wash, and it's naturally temperature regulating. My mum approves, and yours will too. Listeners get 35% off any order at cozyearth.com using code GROWTH.
Hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast, your weekly dose of inspiration and exploration. Join me, your host, Sam Harris, as I discover how mindset can help you do incredible things through my conversations with the world's most interesting people, from tech billionaires to leading scientists, best-selling authors to notorious hackers. The goal is to increase our collective wisdom and attitudes to make us all happier and healthier, wiser and wealthier. Who doesn't want that? Welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Today we have Oren Claff on the podcast, who has written a brilliant book called Pitch Anything about just how to really up your sales game and like make your business a much more easier thing to run and really drive your business in the direction you want to be doing it. And now he's now had a new book called Flip the Script, which I'm super excited to dive into and generally just unpack a bit more about Oren himself, because of he sounds like a pretty interesting guy. So it's my pleasure to have you on the podcast here today. So if there's anything you want to add to that, you're welcome. Otherwise, I quite like to ask my guests their life story in like 3 to 4 minutes, just to sort of get a bit of a picture of like who you are, where you've come from, and where you're going.
Yeah, I think that's good. You know, my background was pretty technical. I was in mechanical engineering. I loved cars and motorcycles and worked on that stuff. And I thought I was destined for a life of technology. I started a software company many years ago before the internet, and it grew actually quite large. We ended up having 70, 80 people cresting through $8.5-9 million of revenue, tens of thousands of customers. And like many fast growth tech companies, we started running short on capital because of the growth pace. So there wasn't really venture capital in those days. There was a little bit, but it was mainly for hardware, not software. Software was mainly homegrown. And we were in Southern California, not Northern California, you know, Palo Alto, where there's a little bit of money that did exist. And so we started running short on money. I started looking around for money, and I met all kinds of people, bankers, and go public and raise money. And they said, you need a marketing plan, you need a financial plan, you need a presentation, you need a pitch deck, you need a growth plan, you need KPIs. And we were just running a software company. I didn't know the language of finance. And so unfortunately for that company, we couldn't raise money fast enough to really turn it into something huge. We did end up selling it. But that created a wound in terms of understanding how to go get money and resources for things you did. And I think I've been trying to heal that wound for the last 20 years. And so that's why I've become so an expert at what does it take to get walk into a room, get on a phone, get on a Skype call, whatever the case is, make in these high stakes scenarios where you have one bite at the apple. You know, when you go to Bank of America to ask for a $100 million construction loan, right? You go make the presentation, they ask you some questions, they go to committee, and they come out with yes or no. And what the no is a no. They're not like, hey, you know, it sounded good. Come back in 2 weeks. You know, improve these things. Let's take another look at it. It's these high stakes meetings, and everybody has them in their life, whether it's a marriage proposal, you know, whatever the case is. High stakes meetings, one bite at the apple, do or die. So that's what I became an expert in, because that's where I died. And I've been what was that movie with Tom Cruise where he goes into the exact same situation over and over again, and he dies every single time, and then he's reconstructed to do it again?
Yeah.
So he solves it. I remember what that was called?
But it's the other one. Yeah, it's good.
It's like Groundhog Day for war. Right?
Yeah, in the future. Yeah.
And so I lived, you know, Groundhog Day for finance, high stakes, and I was willing to go to the front, die, go to the front again, die, until eventually, bit by bit, I started to understand what works and what doesn't. And then eventually I got in with a guy who was just a natural at this, and he changed my worldview on what was possible. And I'll tell you sort of the changing moment for me, which led to Pitch Anything, which led to Flip the Script, which led to, you know, whatever I was telling We have a new CEO here. I was telling him yesterday, we were on vacation in Hawaii and Maui, and I woke up at 6 a.m. to go get a coffee with my little boy. And we walked into a scooter shop. It wasn't open yet, but the scooter shop owner was just sort of sweeping up, and he turns around and he goes, "What? Orrin Claff? So is here in my scooter shop in the far edge of North Shore, Maui?" So the things that have given rise to that life, you know, started and I, at one vivid moment. We were working on a big deal. I had a partner, just call him Jonathan. It's not his name, but he doesn't like his name being used. Really high net worth guy. And we were raising $1 million for a deal. And this was the last $1 million we needed. And the investor was being difficult. They just didn't want to sign some documents. There was a lot of back and forth. And finally, Jonathan just sent an email, all caps, three words, "Lose my number. Lose my number." And I'm, oh my God, the deal's dead. I've never seen anything like that in business. I mean, it's like the rudest, most over the top, all caps. You know, I'm just used to professional. You know, I'm not sure that works for us. You know, we're thinking in a different perspective. Lose my number. I go, ah, the deal's dead. I needed the commission from it. I had worked on it for weeks. I'm like, how did we just kill? And as I'm thinking and being depressed, and it's an impossible situation to get out of, another email comes in and they go, they reply, "We're so sorry. Didn't mean to, you know, stretch the legal document. You're absolutely right. This is a non-issue. We'll have signed documents over to you and wire by the end of the week." And so I was like, how did lose my number turn into closed deal? And it opened a new universe to me of things that are happening below the surface in transactions that are identifiable, that are palatable, that are usable, that really exist, and that can make the difference in high-stakes situations when you have to get something done, because it can change your career, your life, you know, the trajectory of where you're going to end up as a person. So that was a moment when I realized there was a lot more going on in social situations in business than meets the eye.
Mm. That's interesting. Yeah, there's so many things that go into any decision that you kind of think are like simple or rely on just something to do with you and so much other stuff. But it kind of makes me a bit confused as to what were the other things going on in this scenario, because you told quite a good story and painted a nice picture. It'd be nice to complete what was actually happening. Like, what were the things that you realized about that was going on?
Yeah.
I'm in a bit of a mystery here.
Neediness. Neediness kills deals, you know? And so the allowing people to control you when you have the project, you have the idea, you have the company, you have the asset, you have the resource, and all they have is money. See, when you are supplicating to money, money's a commodity. What you have is, in many cases, yourself. You know, if you're a CEO or an entrepreneur or a sales guy or an executive or an admin, you have yourself. And all they have is money. Money's a commodity. You can get it anywhere. You, your integrity, your values, your know-how, your capability, your strengths, your connections, your commitment, your appreciation for problems, your experience having solved the problems before, not the least with your product or your service. That is all an incredible value, especially when you know it can solve the, you know, the buyers or the customers or the investors problem. So all they have is a commodity and you have something amazing. So you who have the real power, the real strength, the real foothold in the transaction shouldn't supplicate with neediness to what is ultimately just a commodity. Now, there's a fine line because you want the money, you want the contract, you want the agreement. But when you stop supplicating or acting needy, then there's a real alignment in power. See, and what ultimately, I mean, you opened Pandora's box with your question. What ultimately is happening is when somebody feels powerful or high status over you, there's some real physical things going on, right? Their vision narrows, they see you at a surface level, and they take high-risk behaviors, things they wouldn't do if the stakes were higher for them. They might text, they might take an email, they might, you know, send you a negotiation tactic that is overreaching, you know, like in this case, an example I gave. So they see you at a surface level, they don't listen very well, their focus narrows, they pay attention to other things, and they engage in high-risk behaviors. That's what happens when somebody feels powerful. So if you make them feel powerful by the things you're doing, you're sort of complicit in your own demise.
That's really interesting.
And you can trace neediness, and I've tried to do it, and I've talked to cognitive psychologists and regular psychologists and not psychologists and amateur psychologists and business people, But I think one way to look at neediness is to go back all the way through, you know, subhuman time, you know, even 70, 80, 90,000 years ago, when there was no surplus of anything. You know, all you had was a woman, a dog, some fire and food, you know, to get through the next 24 hours and potentially a cave. Like those are the things you had. Or you didn't have an Xbox and a bicycle and two computers and you didn't have anything to trade. When somebody came to you and they were needy, that was dangerous. Meant that they were willing to do things and behaviors that were dangerous and risky. You didn't want to be around people that were needy because it would lead to conflict. So neediness creates fear in people. You want to get away from people that are needy. It puts you in the low status position. It elevates other people to power. And this is not a situation where you can close a deal from in modern day commerce.
Yes, pretty good point. I definitely highlighted the first thing you said of neediness kills deals because it's so true. And any kind of relationship besides business, it's just like a huge red flag for anyone. And it either means that you're going to have like a shit deal for yourself or it's just not going to happen at all.
So the thing is, you know, the ability to see where to draw the line and how to draw the line professionally. And then, you know, this is really what Pitch Anything was about, is how to draw the line in your neediness in a professional way that will be accepted and put the buyers or the partners or whatever in alignment with getting the deal done, right? And that then ties into the moral authority. So if you've built up, I think this is, you know, maybe a topic you guys are interested in, but if you build that, your values, what you're willing to do and what you're not willing to do. And those values are in the middle of the fairway for culture, for society, for human beings in general. And they're actually your values, not bullshit. You know, we do things right by the customer. I mean, that's not bullshit. You know, a company should do things, but like.
Yeah, there's a lot of values people have that are just complete bollocks. And you're like, well, you've just written down like a values mission statement and you have no idea what it means.
For sure. So listen, a lot of people I talk to, I say, hey, what are your values? Right. And they say fairness. I'm like, okay. You know, for me, I don't give a fuck. Everybody fucks me over no matter what. Right. Because they can, because I don't care that much. Most of the deals I end up doing aren't fair to me. I do the best I can. Right. But fairness is not really a value to me, right? I try and get a deal done, move forward, do the best deal possible, have a good relationship with everyone. And I don't really view the world in like a win-win relationship, right? Mainly I'm willing to lose and a bit. I don't try to over-maximize. So fairness, I like fairness. Fairness is important. It's probably in our mission statement, but that doesn't make me mad, right? If it's unfair. So, you know, there are these universal values that companies adopt. You know, I've spoken to a company the other day, a large company, and they had, you know, trust and loyalty and fairness and sort of the sources on, you know, if you look up goodwill, you know, what are the other words associated with it? Trust, loyalty, fairness, you know, appreciation. You know, we treat people like we want ourselves to be treated. I mean, it's sort of concepts from the Bible, but that's not really your values. When you communicate your values that you're absolutely dedicated to and you stick to your guns, and that's in Flip the Script, the chapter in Flip the Script is how to stick to your guns. That is what communicates lack of neediness, right? And most business people communicate neediness by reacting to the buyer or, you know, whatever deal they're in, where they're trying to, you know, hire somebody or recruit somebody or get a loan or whatever it is, whatever emotional state or whatever the emotional needs the buyer are, the seller tries to appease those emotional needs. That's how you communicate neediness, right? So if you think about it, that's why, and Tony Robbins and I argue about this, you know, till we die, rapport, right? Yeah. He believes in rapport and I don't believe in rapport, right? Matter of fact, if you come work here and I hear you going, hey, how's the weather over there? Did you see the game? You know, how about that storm? Yeah, you know, oh, Dallas this time of year, how about those Cowboys? Oh, you were fly fishing? I love fly fishing. Oh, you were snowboarding? Yeah, I want to start snowboarding. Rapport, right? Making people like you, to me, is the first step in demonstrating supplication and neediness. Why are their sports, the things they care about, the weather, A, more important than the deal you've come to talk about, and B, more important than the things that you care about? And most of the time, it's a mess up anyway, right? Because like if you come here, and by the way, you're welcome, but at the back of our corporate offices, we've got a warehouse, right? And I've collected over many years some of the iconic motorcycles of all time, right? Magazine cover motorcycles. And so, you know, someone will come in and they will go, "Oh, motorcycles, this is amazing." And, you know, they'll see the motorcycles and they'll go, "You know, when I was in college, I delivered pizza on, I love motorcycles, you know, on a CB360T, right? And, you know, motorcycle this, motorcycle." I'm like, "Yeah, in college, you rode the world's shittiest motorcycle that was ever made in the history of two-wheeled things with an engine in it, right? And these are icons from the history of motorcycle racing. Like, it's not really, not that his subject is better than mine, but it's not really correlation on the same subject. Motorcycles is a huge thing. And so most of the time when we do try and correlate and find rapport, it's a miss anyway. You know, somebody went to Alabama and played on the Alabama football team and you love watching Florida State college football. It doesn't mean anything. You know, it's barely correlated."
Yeah, I just quite agree on like building rapport over meaningless stuff is quite useless. I do think it's really nice to like maybe build, if you can ask like intimate questions and actually talk about something super interesting, it's kind of quite deep. It's actually really nice. You can help build like trust and actually at least gives you sort of 10 minutes of something really interesting to talk about. And maybe you get something from it as well, which I do kind of like doing. But if I'm there to like talk about something specific and going on like a half hour debate of like, do I have like narcissistic ego issues because I go to the gym too much rather than just trying to be healthy or something with someone? It's like, it's an intimate conversation to have, which is quite nice. But do I need to have this right now with someone I've just met? It depends on what it is. It can be fun to unpack.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think in my world, and, you know, I've got our new CEO sitting here and, you know, we're sort of veterans of multi-million or $100 million deals. Nobody goes, "You know what? I don't really like the deal. The terms aren't fair. The technology seems a little bit behind, but there's a better vendor, but man, this guy loves snowboarding. We got to get this done."
Yeah, right? Yeah,
so
exactly.
When the stakes go up, whether they like you, I mean, liking is sort of a minimum requirement and they're going to find that out over time. Especially when you're talking to a professional buyer who knows how to unpack a seller over, you know, a series of calls, meetings, proposals, exchanges and negotiation, they're going to really see who you are. And whether, you know, you guys both like snowboarding is not going to impact the final closing of this real estate deal, this SaaS software sale, this government contract, you know, whatever it is. They're going to buy because there's value there and there's certainty that the, you say will happen in the future will actually happen as you say they will without, you know, high friction. So they're looking for trust and certainty, not correlation to different kinds of sports.
Yeah. Although I would like completely counteract that statement in terms of people do like relationships and things. And sure, I have two people to like buy something from and one's like my daughter's husband or something, I'm probably going to buy it from him because it will help something.
If it's a bicycle, okay.
Yeah, I mean, if one's shit and one's not.
$50 million rack of servers that you're going to go public with your company impact 2,000 investors, you know, who have put money in your company, have you made securities compliant promises to over a series of years, this is not so much a factor.
Yeah, true. But
true.
If I'm going to have to work with this person a lot, I would not want to work with someone who's a dickhead. So I would like to have someone that I would like having around my office and maybe I could go for a pint with after dinner and after work or something.
This is why we go back to the conversations of values. You can't really understand somebody by whether they like the Boston Celtics, the Patriots, or the Green Bay Packers, or they, you know, follow the news on the Storm or what side of Brexit they fall on. What you can understand is their value. So for example, if you look at our customer roster, right? We don't have any 75-year-old Chinese women, right, who are our customers, you know, in our enterprise services group. Nothing wrong with them and there's nothing wrong with us. But in general, we like to be friends with our customers. We end up going on trips with them. You know, we close large deals. They generally have kids. We have kids. Our kids are friends. You know, my little boy plays hockey and our value system matches up with theirs and they like us because we share this, you know, we don't stop when we're tired. We stop when we're done. Sometimes we lose money, right? Even though, you know, on a project we've committed to do and just the edges fall off and we still have to keep doing it. You know, these are around values when, you know, here's for example, when I'm talking to a customer, I'll say, listen, this is a perfect example. They'll go, you know, we'll make a pitch and we'll talk to them about it and we'll negotiate a little bit. And they go, yeah, Orin, sounds good. You know, I think it's good. Let's go ahead and do it. Right. And they're sort of, you know, rolling over and showing their neck. And I say, no, even though that's a yes, I'll say that doesn't work for me. Like, we're going to try and do a $30 million deal together. Yeah, let's go do it. You know, it sounds good. That is way too hard. I really need you to say, Oren, I love you. I love the way it works. So excited about this project. Let's go make this happen together. Because I'll tell you why. In a big project like this, whether you're installing servers or doing a government contract or raising money or selling a company or, you know, installing accounting software for a large company, whatever it is that you do, you know, the higher the stakes, there will come a point where there's a disagreement. Something went wrong. And this is what I say to our customers. Some Sunday night, you will be expecting a set of financials, a pitch deck, so you can go present on a Monday morning, right? We'll have promised you that. You'll be expecting it. You hit refresh and it doesn't show up. And that's our fault. And we did it wrong. You're going to call us up Monday morning, go, what the hell, blah, blah, you know, swear. And we're going to say, I'm sorry. You know, we missed that. And sorry is not going to be enough. And we still have to be mad at each other. We still have to be uncomfortable. We still have to have high anxiety. We still, blame has to still be in place. And yet we still have to be able to go forward and not break up and not ruin the work and make it about the work. And still in that state of irreconcilable issues in that moment, continue forward on the project. And until we see that in each other, we can't go do this thing together. So that's what I think we need to work on, is making sure that when we do get to that point, because it always happens, both of us are big enough to continue and go forward. So I'll have that conversation the bigger the deal is. And so that's how people get to know us and me, by what I believe in and my experience of how values matter as you get into higher and higher stake deals. With a TV set, you don't need to have that conversation.
Definitely. So, speaking a lot about values, what would you say are your defining values then? Because you sort of alluded to quite a few, but like, can you just clearly say what are your values and why?
Yeah, sure. So I think the values are the things that, at least in the audience that I work with, you know, when I ask people, what are the things that make you mad, right? And so with Pitch Anything, and I put a lot of content out there, and now I've written a new book, Flip the Script. It's $22 or $14 or free, or, you know, if you can download it as a free, or, you know, so I put out an enormous amount of content on the blog, you know, as do you guys. You know, I have a podcast and the books and everything. And we daily get people go, hey, I read Pitch Anything. I underlined everything. I went and did that stuff and I raised $3 million. I closed the biggest deal of my life. I'm now a good salesperson. So for me, my value is I cannot accept negativity about Oren Claff or Pitch Anything, because we've just created too much positivity and changed people's lives. So, you know, I see other people on Instagram like, hey, when somebody's negative, let it blow over you. I don't accept that. I won't work with someone or a company or a person or an individual, and we'll unplug them. People say, oh, you know, your haters make you. Not me. I unplug them from my life. So one of my values is negativity. Won't take it. And, you know, a second one is we won't work harder than you on your company, right? Even though we're the vendor, you hired us to write a pitch or raise money or help sell your company or train your salespeople or create a financial model or change your company in some way or get you a bank line of credit. One of my values is you can't ask us to work harder than you will on your own company. So those are the kind of things that people will hear from me right at the outset. Here's another one, right? People come in and they'll see our capability and my track record and talk to me, and they'll scope out something, you know, huge. Sometimes they'll come in and say, you know, we want you to raise $1 billion. We want you to do this $1 billion deal for us. And I say, you know, one of my values is I don't like to move too fast. And I say, look, let's do this in this way. A, let's see if we like each other, which is what these conversations and meetings are about. B, let's see if we can work together. C, let's see if we can build something small that's valuable and good. Let's see if we can build something good. And then let's see if other people think it's good. And if we can check those three boxes, then let's scope something out that's larger. So those are where my value system, and I think the buyers that we have those same values, and they come in. And if they don't care about that stuff, then we end up not being able to do business with them.
Cool. Yeah, I really like the last one. Yeah, second one, like not working harder than the people, is quite interesting, kind of controversial to what you'd normally hear. Then the first point about accepting no negativity, that seems to go right in the opposite of like all you hear about how to improve and growth mindset and like taking on feedback and being able to hear what's wrong with what you're doing to improve it. Do you not feel that maybe you should invite some negativity and like examine your flaws?
So how old are you, by the way? I didn't have, or give me an age range.
An age range, 25 to 30.
Okay. All right. Listen, fuck you. Okay. Fuck all you 25-year-olds telling me, you know, how the stoic ethic, you know, how the I've been doing this for a long time. I'm very comfortable. So in my swim lane, you know, I'm the one that gets 5-6 emails a day. You changed my life. You know, and I have an online platform with 5,000 people in it. And this is maybe the world's largest petri dish of negotiation, business development, you know, sales technology. And so every week we do a call, you know, an hour, hour and a half, and a bunch of people come on and they'll pose their problem. Hey, you know, we have a buyer that's stuck. They won't move forward. They won't move backwards. How do we move it? We have a buyer that's not responding. We have a buyer is now saying that we promised more than we actually promised them. It's in the contract. You know, for example, we're the best provider for, we just made a pitch for a company, a hospital group. There's only one person on a 10-person committee that for no reason hates us, right? But she's, nobody will decide against her. So we hear all these problems, you know, every week, every day. And then I'll say, go do this. Here's the solution. So in that case, right, I say, you know, for the woman who's saying, you know, something negative about your company, here's the solution for it. Then they'll go do it and they'll come back. That worked. So I'm very comfortable that I've delivered the value. And in this stuff, I know how to fix these problems. And for people who listen and want to truly fix their problems, I'll help out. And for people who are negative, they can go over to the other places that there are to go. Now, look, am I completely unwilling to do self-introspection? Of course, I, you know, everybody has to do that at some point. But you have to at some point say, this is what we value. This is what we do. We do a good job at it. We continually improve. We get feedback from the market. A large majority of people love it. And we're just not going to pay attention and buy into the outliers because we don't have to.
That's interesting. As in going somewhere as a brand, it is much easier if you could have demonstrated exactly what your values are and you just do what it is you're doing. And rather than alluding to what you're saying much earlier about being needy, and if you are just needy for money and you just do whatever someone's asking and taking on their feedback and then every complaint, you end up just doing a bunch of things that you don't actually want to be doing anyway, and you lose all track of your values and working on things you don't want to be working on.
Yeah, I think people get into, they find themselves in fetch me another rock. And as good as we are here as an organization, if we don't pay attention to this, we end up doing this, right? Fetch me another rock is the buyer, you know, or the partner, the transaction goes, hey, we really like what you do. It's fantastic. We really want to onboard this. You know, I want to take it up to committee. This is great. Can you make me a spreadsheet that shows the ROI, you know, and you know, really lays out the value proposition. Oh, this is great. You know, we're a little concerned about the technology. You have a white paper that describes the technical aspects of, you know, your implementation and what the math is, you know, behind your, you know, AI machine learning solution is, oh yeah, here's the white paper. And so eventually it's like, oh, we love the blue rock. Do you have a blue rock with orange dots? We love the blue rock with orange dots. Now we need a pink rock with blue dots on it. Oh, thanks for the pink rock with a blue dot on. Now we just need a red rock to take it up to committee, to take it up to CFO, to take it up to the board of directors. You know, great. We took the red rock up to the board of directors. Now all we need is a green rock, white stripes, and we need to show it to Sasquatch. And Sasquatch has to sign off on it. And then of course, you know, so fetch me another rock is something that people get into unless they have values. And they can communicate those values about what they're willing to do in a deal and not do. Because when your values appear out of anger or frustration at the end of a project, the buyer's hearing about it for the first time, like, whoa, where's all this coming from? Well, you always had it. You just didn't communicate it in the beginning.
Nice. Yeah, it does make more sense. So I'm not sure. It's always like a gray line of like nothing's black and white. And I think even though you say you know negativity at all, there is room for some in terms of, well, as in like some feedback and like thinking about realigning things. And it makes a lot of sense the way you've spoken about it. It's not just a complete, I'll never listen to anyone that says something bad.
Yeah, of course.
Like a complete sort of dickhead about it. But no, it's quite nice having like a refreshing view about how to look at things. It's useful.
Yeah, it's individualistic. Like when I wrote the book, when I wrote Pitch Anything, I remember, you know, my agent called and my publisher called in a quite negative tone of voice, right? And they said, what are you doing? Like, why aren't you going to book signings? And like all authors do. And I'm like, you mean like go to a Barnes & Noble and sign five books for little ladies, you know, who are there that day at the Barnes & Noble. Yeah. Yeah. You got to go to, you know, book signings and schedule. I'm like, you know, like in Poughkeepsie and Wichita Falls and, you know, West Hollywood and San Jose, like those kinds of Barnes & Nobles. And like, yeah, yeah. There's a, like, even William Shatner goes to book signings. I go, well, William Shatner should have written a good book. Wouldn't have to go to book signings in West Hollywood for five little old ladies. So you can get that feedback from people who know what they're doing, but these markets constantly change. You know, in the world that I live in, things are constantly changing, you know, especially if you're in social media, you know, if you're in web technologies. I mean, what existed yesterday, maybe not yesterday, 6 months ago is advice. Somebody come in and say, hey, you're doing it wrong. That advice has expired in many cases. So you have to be quite self-sufficient today with your values, with the feedback and the direction you get from other people. There aren't these long cycles of business and tech advice, you know, that the, right? Because there used to be this network of retired executives, you know, who had retired, and then the young guys coming up, we'd get to meet. And so the things that they knew about business from 25, 30 years ago, 15 years ago, right, were incredibly relevant for the 19, 20, 21, 24-year-olds coming up in their own businesses. But those networks have died because 15-year-old know-how is, you know, unless it's really on accounting, which hasn't changed that much, right, is almost, can be completely backwards, anathema to what you need to do today. So, you know, where's that feedback coming from? And what is your willingness to take feedback from people? Hey, maybe I would say like this, if I can make the point. I'll have a lot of guys come to me and they say, hey, we're trying to raise money, $3 million, right? For our, you know, dating app for grandmas that includes poker and pet walking API management, right? Sounds like a pretty good deal today. And they'll say, you know, we met with Connor Perkins and we went with True Ventures and we met with these angels, right? And they'll say, what True Ventures told us is we were too niche focused and we needed to be broader, right? And then they'll say, you know, what this angel told us is that we should white label our technology and not invest the time to, you know, build technology today. And then what Kleiner Perkins told us is that we need a technical co-founder, right? And I'll always say, okay, so you got all this feedback from these guys. Did they invest? Do not take advice from people who are really just trying to get you out of their building and go away and not want to meet you again, right? They're actually trying to get you to leave and being comforting and giving you a piece of advice for you to go away with. Never take advice from somebody who doesn't have stakes in your business, especially when it's core advice to the decision-making of what you're going to be, how you're going to do things, and ultimately what your business model is, right? That free advice is either useless or worse than useless. And I'll see people come up with a pitch, you know, which is really something I know well, which is a Franken pitch, right? They've taken advice from 7, 12, 15 different people and then just made a composite of other people's advice about their life, their company, their deal. And it's a total mess. So, you know, I think maybe we beat that subject to death, but you can
Yeah, definitely when you take like all the advice from different places, you can just end up running in a million different directions and actually going nowhere. And just a waste of time. Yeah, it'd be really interesting to unpack a bit more about your general, I guess, growth mindset in terms of, you sounded like you naturally weren't that good at sales. And
yeah,
you said you just kept getting up and like failing. But I'd like to understand more the process of how you improved and like develop your confidence. That's possible.
Yeah, I think that's good. I mean, I think if you think about golf, right, or Olympic lift, I don't play golf, but I do Olympic lift. You know, it's part of CrossFit and nice. These are very complex movements, right? That I don't know anything about golf, but I understand it's the same thing. Like watching videos or reading books or talking about it cannot improve your Olympic lift at all. It's just, you know, unless somebody, you see somebody doing it correctly and you can in three dimensions copy it and then get feedback. And so I feel like the pitch and sales is very similar. That trying and failing and trying and failing and trying and failing without really some calibration to somebody who knows what they're doing is very difficult or impossible. And because, you know, as I read the books and I did those things, the books make sense when you read them. I'm sure on a lot of topics, you know, take like, you know, NLP or hypnosis or the personality-based sales or the 10-step, you know, straight line sales model. It all sounds good and it makes sense and it's logical, right? But then you go into a meeting and you're facing somebody who can give you a check for $1 million, which can change the whole year or the, you know, the arc of your career or your life. And you go, did he look, I touched him on the shoulder. Did he look up and to the left? What did I suppose? Am I in step three? Is he a ESTJ or a LMNOP? You know, these, they're too complex.
Definitely.
To know where you are and what to do next, especially if you only got it in a training program or in a book. So then what you do, most people do, is they just default to the basics, right? So the basic programs are to give people features of your product, your service, explain to them the benefits, how the features, you know, will help them be better in life, tell a whole, wrap a whole story around it, go for the trial close. So what do you think? Is this something you'd be interested? Do you have any questions? Stop me if you have any questions. And then of course the objections come out. Oh, you know, we haven't really budgeted for this year. You know, we have a vendor we're currently happy with. It's more than we thought it would be. You know, whatever the objections are. And now it's the first time in a sale that you really feel empowered to do something. Like there's something right in front of you that you know how to do, which is fight and argue, argumentation, high school debate club over these objections. Well, you know, I know you don't have budget right now, but we can finance it and that will whatever overcome the objection. And then they'll say, well, you know, that's good. You make a good point. Something we have to think about. Then, of course, the way you control somebody thinking is to discount, provided that, well, you know, if we could get the number right, you think we could get closer to a decision today or this week? Well, you know, if the number was right, we could move a little bit faster. And now you're just giving away margin. So that's sort of what we slip into. But then, as I said before, I started seeing some naturals not do any of that stuff, right? And actually do things that I thought would ruin a sale immediately. And so, for example, I saw my partner walked into a meeting that, you know, was really high level. We're in San Francisco, to Embarcadero, you know, up in one of these big conference rooms. You're looking out over the bay and they walk in all their people. And generally the way these things go is you crosstalk and, hey, how was your weekend? You know, did you watch the tennis match and everything like that? And Jonathan just goes, hey, so look, I see you guys just showed up for the 10:03 meeting. Why don't we get that one started? I thought, okay, here's another one going the wrong direction. And he goes, does anybody need fluids in or out? If not, let's get started. We got a lot to get through here. You know, in the next 10, 15 minutes, we're going to tell you about the project. Then we're going to give you some time in relation to our project to tell us what's important to you. And if our circles overlap, we'll figure out a way to go forward. Right. And I understand you guys want to learn a lot about the project and you'll be evaluating us, but as much as you'll be evaluating the project and us and our background and everything, we're going to spend our time here evaluating you. So there's a lot to get to. Again, fluids in or out. If not, let's get going. And so when I heard that, I said to myself, coming from sort of an average frustrated background, this meeting is over before it started. But as I looked around, everybody snapped into alignment, put their phones away, put their laptop faces down, and gave 100% attention. And what I realized, although it was counterintuitive, is Russell had communicated, I'm a professional. You're in the hands of a professional. This meeting is going to go the same way you run your internal meetings. Focused, timely, professional, based on common ways of behaving in our commerce system. And you're going to understand with great clarity what's happening, why it's happening, why us, why now, and the value proposition. Why else, why now, and the value proposition. So he didn't use those words exactly, but as I started unpacking how he was doing things, he was basically coming in and saying, hey, listen, we have information on how everything is changing in this industry. We know how things are going to operate for the next couple of years after the change completely happens. We're one of the few people that know this. We're going to tell you what the value proposition is, what the change that we see is, why we think you're going to get sucked up and consumed by that change, why you should work with us, and why do it now, and how to build trust with us in a very short period of time. That's ultimately what he was sub-communicating. And so as I unpacked it, I said, well, as clumsy as I am, I'll just come in and say these things overtly. Here's how things are changing. Here's why you should work with us. Here's why you should do it now. Here's the value proposition. Here's the ROI. Here's the key assumptions. Here's how this is a pro forma. Here's who's on our team. And here's a decision-making timeline that we're willing to live with. And so as I started doing the things that he was doing as a natural, overtly, it started working better. And so I think that was a very long answer to a short question.
Well, I mean, they ask super long questions, do you? Yes.
Yeah, you ask.
I liked it. It's interesting. I really liked his pitch. It was good.
Yeah.
I could have been there like, whoa, this guy's a god. Cool, I'll do whatever he says. He demonstrates. Yeah.
I mean, that's what the new book is about, is how to communicate, right, that I'm part of your industry and that I'm an expert, right? Because if somebody trusts you, you know, communication that you have a place in the industry, you know the norms, you know the mores, you know the KPIs, right? That you know people in the industry, that people know you, and you have your place in that industry. That's really all about status, right? And status communicates trust. Low status, low trust, high trust, right? Mm-hmm. And the second thing is, if you can pitch someone about their problem without asking them a million questions about it, go, hey, I got a good idea of what's going on with you guys, right? And you can pitch them as an expert, and they believe you're an expert. Now you've got two things. You've got status and expertise, which to me, in my mind, in my tiny pea brain, is trust and certainty. Status is trust. Expertise provides certainty. That's what the naturals are doing in their own inimitable way. They're creating trust and certainty, and that's a deal.
Cool. Yeah. Okay. So talking about like your new book, I'm really liking the whole kind of concept of unusual ways to do business that are actually much more simple and making a lot of sense. I would really like to know, what do you think was the hardest thing for you to write about in the book?
Frames, you know. So my buddies and I, you know, Jonathan and everything, we talked about frames, frame control, the power frame, the intrigue frame, the prize frame, the scarcity frame, you know, all these ways of looking at the world. And then we tried to write about it, and it was just confusing. So then I got every single white paper, document, book on framing. And there's a huge body of political information on framing, you know, frame the narrative. And I go, wow, well, this is going to be easy to plagiarize. I mean, copy and paste. I mean, reinterpret.
Exactly.
Right. Mm-hmm. Oh, so you've written a book.
I do science. That's
yeah, right.
Exactly. I am writing actually at the moment. It's been a lot of fun.
Right. So take all this sciencey stuff, dumb it down for business people, because I know the power of frames. We use them, and what it does is it provides a common language for people who are dealing with other business people in social situations to talk to each other. Oh, they're using the power frame. How are we going to overcome that? We're going to use the intrigue frame. Let's stack two frames, right? The prize frame and the intrigue frame. And it's just, these are lenses that you put on a situation to help somebody see what it is you have, why it's valuable, what your time frame is. Look, we're all familiar. You know, if you're new to frames and you're listening to this, you know, you already know what frames are because there's a time frame, right? So you walk in to a Lamborghini dealership, I mean, a Toyota dealership, whatever it is, right? And you go, hey, you know, we're looking at the 4Runner. Right. And they go, well, what's your time frame? Right. Hey, motherfucker, my time frame is 5 minutes. I have to be in this car and driving. And all kinds of frames fall out of that. Right. So they say, what's your time frame? And you say, you know, we're just looking. Right. There's two totally different set points, lenses through which to see the entire interaction. We're just looking, or I need to be out of here in 5 minutes with a car. Right. Like, that's how I negotiate for cars today. I walk in and I go, hey, this 4Runner, how much is it? It's $48,000. I go, great, I'll take it, right? Because you can't buy my weekend for $2,000, which is the most you're going to get off of a $48,000 4Runner is $2,000, but you're going to spend a weekend doing it, right? And you cannot buy my weekend for $2,000. Try. You know, my little boy goes to hockey. We go surfing. I got a bike ride to get to. So anyway, you're familiar with time frames, but there's other kinds of frames, control business. So we looked at all this political framing material and science, and it just was gobbledygook. You know, unless you are inside of politics or you're inside these nuanced areas where you already use framing, you didn't know anything about framing, it didn't make any sense. And in fact, when I go to speak, you know, the companies always go, yeah, we want to hear about frames. And of course I try and an audience that's coming fresh into frames knows nothing about it during a keynote. And I'm pretty good at this stuff, can't ramp up an audience on what frames are and how they work from the stage. It's just a subject that I wrote. I almost gave up on it two or three times. I called in a buddy of mine and we just figured out how to write it and we succeeded with it. But it was the most difficult thing I ever undertook, was writing about a cognitive idea that is so abstract but controls every social interaction. It's very hard to do.
No, I get it. It's sort of related in some ways to mindsets as well. It's kind of like a cognitive thing that kind of is a bit of a meta way of viewing the world and kind of relates to everything. And sometimes I kind of completely fluff it up where I try to explain it to people.
Well, I think the problem with mindset is it doesn't give you a common language to talk to people, right? That, you know, if you're a couple executives in your company, right? And you're going in and you're sort of talking, hey, our mindset is going to be positive, right? Our mindset is going to be firm, right? But those aren't lenses.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are positions, right? And so I'll give you an example, you know, and you read the book, the prize frame is, I think we started off talking about this. Who is the prize? Who's the most important person in this whole interaction? If you make it the buyer, right, then they're the prize that you're trying to win. So that's a frame. If you make the prize you, then the buyer is trying to win your attention, your product, your service. So that's why I think frames are different than mindsets.
Yeah. It's definitely related, but like fundamentally kind of like a different way of like framing it to go with the frames.
Yeah. Welcome to the challenge of
nightmare. Cool. I like it. But yeah, it is more challenging to explain than mindsets already. So I'll let you deal with it, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Oh, believe me, I get the patron saint. I'm the patron saint of tough things to explain and tough deals. Nobody gives me the easy ones.
Definitely. I think we kind of can relate on making things difficult for ourselves. And yeah. I think the way that you explain things, I kind of quite relate to it. I can see where you maybe used to have more challenges, as in certainly when I'm trying to like explain things, I kind of unpack the wrong things first and get like a bit in the wrong direction and go off some tangents to eventually bring it all back and it makes sense. But it takes quite a long time. And some people just go like straight to the heart of it. And you're like, wow, why couldn't I have just done that? Like,
yeah.
And your explanation has been a bit long, not to like give you any negativity, but it seems like you probably got so much better at this than you maybe used to be, perhaps.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because we just proposed a big speaking gig and my speaking agent was tragically killed, a young woman, and she was killed in a car accident. It was very tragic. And so now I've got a new speaking agent and I'm sort of ramping her up on, you know, my background. And to your point, you know, she found some videos, you know, in their whatever Dropbox from like 5 years ago, and she sent them to a client. I was copying. I'm like, oh my, delete those from never.
Yeah.
Let those go out of your email ever again. That was like shockingly horrible. Like, here's a modern video of me. And like the gap from 5 years ago is, you know, I look at 5 year old me speaking and it's embarrassing. And so, yeah, this is stuff that you, if you're focused on it, you're trying hard, you get better and better at. But I wanted to key off of something you said, which is like, you know, you try something, you say that doesn't, you know, sort of this Instagram mantra, you know, Edison didn't fail. He just found another way not to make the light bulb, right? This is this Instagrammable quote, you know, 10X, try harder, hustle. I think that's really one of the things I stand against today is this hustle porn, right? Which is try harder, work more, do it another way. So I go back to this Olympic lift, right? And even like I've been doing Olympic lift for 5-6 years. I feel like I'm good at it. And when the weight gets heavy, right, there's this sort of notion that you bounce it off your mid leg and that gives it some additional upward momentum. That makes any sense, right? So you're lifting the weight. Yeah. You're not going to clear it up to your shoulders. You bounce it off. That gives it like a jolt upwards. And you continue to clean it up and then get it on your shoulders. And so now I have an Olympic lift coach and he goes, if you really watch the Olympic lifters, right, it looks like they're bouncing it. That's why everybody does it. But that's just the moment where it pauses before they snap their hips, and the hips gives it that upper room, but it never touches them, right? And so you can observe people in social situations, in pitch situations, in business situations. You can watch Elon Musk all day long. Actually, I have another good example of this. And do everything that he does, but unless you know what he's really doing, you can fail even worse by observing the things he's doing. And so, you know, I always come back from these heavy lifts with these, this is how we got in this situation with these bruised thighs. And they're like, where is that coming from? I'm like, oh, I'm just bouncing it like the pros do. And they go, look, watch this. The pros don't bounce it. But my current partner, Jack, at Intersection Capital, the way we got together is I was putting out pitch decks for years, and I was winning deals against them. Finally, you know, his competitors, he just called me up. He goes, we've been trying to copy those pitch decks, you know, for 2 years, and we can't get it right. I'm like, yeah, because you're copying what you see. You don't know what's powering, like, the mindset that goes to create those. And once I showed him the mindset, the understanding, the sequencing, the storytelling, the narrative, the organization, the structure behind it, now he does it as well or better than I can. Right. So for years, I tried to copy it, couldn't do it. I explained to them a little bit, you know, a couple of hours of how I formulate those pitch decks. And now he's as great at it as I ever was. So this is, I think, the problem with trying hard and hustling and doing it yourself and then coming back and self-introspection, evaluating and journaling and all this stuff. You really need to know from people who've got it working, whether they're natural or experts, what are they really doing that you're seeing that's creating that impact?
I agree with most of what you say, but I do really like introspection and journaling and things. I do feel like I get a lot from that.
I know, because you're 25 years old. You love journaling.
Maybe once I'm older, I won't need to do it so much, perhaps.
I journal every day, but I do it differently now because I have a little boy, I have a 5-year-old. And so every day I record something that he did, you know, that really affected our, take a photo and then I'll write it on paper. You know, I love pen and ink, and I'll write it on paper. And by the way, my wife wants me to put it in a book, you know, a spiral bound book. So it's sequential, but I grab a piece of paper and I'll put a photo on it and I'll write what he did, why it was important, what I love about it. And just, you know, trying to, and in that it's a little bit of journaling, and it doesn't feel so, you know, deeply introspective, but at least I'm recording the passing of time. So if you love journaling, you're never going to stop, but it will change. You'll get sick of yourself by the time you're 42.
Well, I think that's one of the things I do like about journaling is getting sick about being a whiny bitch about something consistently for a week. You're like, shit, why am I still whining about this? Either I need to just stop caring or just not do it and things. And so I still get benefit from that a bit. And it's interesting. But I do quite like also what you're saying earlier about your videos from 5 years ago being quite embarrassing, and certainly this podcast and things, I'm kind of aware that I am quite young, and maybe half the time I'm not really doing the best job of it, but it's so much better than it was 2 years ago. I'm aware that maybe I'll look back at it in a few years' time and be like, well, crap, I did really not ask the right questions, or kind of sound like a bit of an idiot the whole time whilst I was speaking, but at least the guest was okay, and at least I kind of know that I'm getting better every time. And it's kind of nice to observe myself doing these things, and I could just say, oh, I'm not good enough, so I'll just never do it. But I need, I need to carry on doing it to get to the point where I'll actually be at the stage where I really want to be, in that sense.
You're in the game, you know, so that's, so Instagram, 90% of the battle is just showing up. No, it's not 90%, but it's a good 4-5%. You also have to have skills and work hard and put resources and time and money in it and be lucky and, have relationships that care about you and treat people well and, actually be focused on adding value to people's lives, but not so much value that you're giving it away. That's 90% of it. But it's good to be showing up.
Yeah, definitely. So one thing I like talking about is the future. So you're kind of an expert in the sales arena. Do you think it's going to change?
I don't know. I never sold, right? I mean, I come from deal making. The book is very popular in the sales arena, and I try and help salespeople be less needy and structure their presentation. And they like that material. It's like saying, Dan Ariely is in the sales arena. I mean, he's in the psychology arena, in which salespeople find his stuff very useful. I try not to pigeonhole, in sales.
Yeah. Okay. Well, basically, whatever arena you feel like you maybe are an expert in, where do you see it in 5 years' time? It's like, do you think there is going to be a fundamental shift that you might be able to predict, or are you going to try and change what you're doing?
So there's 7,000 companies in lead gen, CRM, lead management, funnel hacking, you know, AI, lead nurturing, lead, you know, whatever it is, Zapier APIs, right? And so companies are drowning in leads and they're driven by technology. So become super smart about the technology. Once you have a lead, and I'm not talking about, you know, selling a TV or a $5,000, $10,000, $100,000, $500,000 thing. You actually have somebody, hey, I'm interested in working with you, buying from you, doing a deal with you, being involved with you. No amount of technology, any technology you use to try and convert that lead will make the conversion process worse, right? Case in point, you know, if you and I were working on a deal, we couldn't get Zoom working for like three times. Not your fault, not my fault, maybe not even Zoom's fault, the cloud's fault. Conversion is 100% the stuff we're talking about here. The lost art of sequencing your information for a buyer, for a deal, in the way that the buyer wants to buy, in a way that you're not being obsequious or pushy or needy, in a way that fits the way buyers buy today, which they've really gamified buying. So one is we become dependent on tech. I see companies drowning in leads, right? You think about like these, just in my mind, I see this vision of these hikers, you know, have gone up Kilimanjaro and the weather has moved in and they've used up all their supplies and it's 3 days and they're coming down and they're dying of thirst, but they're walking on ice, right? And they're dying of thirst because they can't convert the ice into water. It's too cold. And so I see companies, the formulas are no longer working in terms of conversion. Used to be you had 100 leads, you pitched them, you know, you're going to get 10% into the pipeline. And out of those, you're going to convert 2% in pipeline management. Today, you see conversion rates can be zero. You can have 100 leads and convert zero of them. People don't know how to talk in a way that buyers today want to buy. So they're losing, you know, and buying has been gamified, right? Buyers today have more information than, you know, you do in many times about your product. And they're at a different point in the sales cycle than you may think they are. And they're just looking for a price, features, and ROI. Then they want to put you in a box, you know, press the hold button, say, I'll be right back, and look for that same thing for cheaper or free. And so that's the game that buyers play. And unless you know how to handle that today, things are very different than the way they were 5-6 years ago.
I'm just wondering what, like, the take-home message from that would be in terms of what would I then do? What would I be doing differently in 5 years' time apart from just making a mess?
Buyers buy how they want to buy, not how you want to sell.
Yeah.
Here's the takeaway. Today, things are bought, they aren't sold.
Yes. I like that.
Yeah. And that's good because that's the first line, first page of Flip the Script. I don't like being pressured into making a purchase, and I'm not alone. Over decades of being marketed, pitched, and sold to and lied to, we've all grown resistant to sales persuasion. The moment we feel pressure to buy, we pull away. And if we're told what to do or think, our defenses go up. In other words, buyers don't put much trust in you and your ideas. However, everyone trusts their own ideas. Accordingly, today products are bought, not sold.
Right, on point. And a nice quote to finish things off there. Okay, so just a few very final questions that I like to go into. What's the kindest thing that someone has ever done for you?
Oh yeah, that's great. I've never been asked that question. So when I was writing Pitch Anything, I wasn't able to work because the book started dragging me under, just started taking a lot of time. You know, if you produce a science or science paper or a science project or a book, it pulls you under because you want to get it right. And I wasn't able to work as I was finishing it. And it was really becoming stressful. You know, spending money, but not earning money. And I was at the gym working out with a buddy of mine, and he was having his own situation. He was in a lawsuit and real pain for him. And he was under his own stress and wasn't sure what the outcome was going to be in his own life. So two uncertain people, longtime friend. I get home and I open my duffel bag and there's a $10,000 check in there. And that allowed me to, without any concern or worry, finish writing the book. And that's an easy answer to that question.
Wow, nice friend.
Yeah.
Yeah, me, it's a bit of a hard one to kind of recommend other people to go and do. Like, oh, if your friend's trying to write a book, just like leave a check in the gym bag.
Yeah.
As in showing up for someone, if you are able to, I think super important. And yeah, definitely try and do more of that. So cool. Thank you. That's a really nice story. And then what is possibly one of your earliest memories that you can like really remember quite vividly?
So I was born in Jerusalem. And I think really my first functioning memory is we moved from Jerusalem to Wisconsin. And when the door first opened to the back of our station wagon to where we were going to be living in Madison, I just remember the cold sitting in the back of the station wagon and never having experienced. So it must have been 4 or something like that. So cold. My first memory is of cold.
Wow. Did that scare you at the time?
Yeah, thanks for the flashback. You know, I've been in therapy for 35 years, getting that out of my mind. But now, thanks to this situation, I'm back in therapy.
Yeah. Wow. That's how you frame it.
Yeah. It did scare me.
Cool. Do you think it kind of put you off being there, or were you able to kind of be positive afterwards?
You know, I just have to look at the final. I'm a positive, you know, I look at the final product. So I feel like I overcame that trial.
Yeah. But do you think maybe that helped you in the long run, realize that you can get over your problems, and perhaps this is why you became like much better at sales when you were initially faced with a problem? Or
I would answer this, like if you look culturally at Israelis, you know, I wasn't in Israel for very long, 4 or 5 years, but I think I was there long enough to get that tenacity, because my parents aren't, you know, aren't Israeli by birth. And so I think I was long enough there to get that culture into my makeup, you know, of tenacity, of sort of continuing forward, you know, even trying to find strength out of weakness and whatever Instagram quote, you know, want to use, the way is forward, not backwards. The view is from the top, you know, whatever.
Cool. Yeah, I definitely noticed that whilst I was out in Israel. It's an interesting country. Okay. Have you got any questions you want to ask me about? Or is there anything that I should have asked you that I haven't asked?
Well, I think, you know, the thing that is so important for me today in, you know, the way buyers are today is how do you show someone you're an expert? And I think that's ultimately, you know, maybe for the next time, because it's a whole topic. Because today when I meet people, they tell people they're an expert. How do you show people you're an expert? Because once you show someone and they believe you're an expert, then they start to have certainty that the things you're promising really will happen. And so I think there's a huge line, although it seems nuanced, between telling people you're an expert, right?
Yeah.
And showing is showing your likes or showing your, you know, track record or showing the testimonials or, you know, that's definitely telling.
Yeah, it seems like saying, I know a really great story. I've got a really great joke, but not telling it. Like, I don't think you're funny or a good storyteller just because you told me that. Like, I need to hear the great story or the joke. And I'm like, shit, this guy's funny.
Yeah, it's a great way of putting it. So how do you show someone that you're an expert in their kind of problem? Once somebody feels like you've solved their problem 1,000 times in a row, it's pretty much a boring push-up to do it.
Yeah,
you've accomplished a lot.
That's why CVs are so useless. But yeah, cool.
Yeah.
I like that tip. Thanks. Then I guess, as you spoke about my age a bit, I'm actually 28, by the way, soon to be 29.
Okay. All right. Oh, so I take it back. I take all that swearing back. Actually, I'm a lot more seasoned and mature than I thought.
But yeah, I'm still very young and open to feedback. Any big life tips that you think I should really concentrate on?
I think I would concentrate on this notion of when you see this runaway success in people, whether it's podcasting or science or something or book writing that you care about, this is mostly powered by luck. I have worked with billionaires, hundreds of 100 millionaires, 1,000, you know, 10 millionaires. And sometimes there's just like these incredibly smart, talented Elon Musks. Although maybe if you follow Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos all the way back, it's just, there's a moment in time that was unbelievable. Most of it is luck. Right. So this is going to sound trite, but work hard, carry water, chop wood, get to the end of the day with poise and grace and move forward. When you do all this work with expectations and that you are deserving of something, it starts to unravel pretty quickly. And right. So, you know, maybe that's high school gym coach, but maybe that's the best advice, you know, high school gym coach advice. Oh, is is so much, you know, 100 million, 10 million, 1 million, 5 million, 70 million, 1 billion. Most of it is luck.
Cool. Thanks. That's like, I think, quite true. It's pretty interesting studying people that have been massively successful in some, yeah, just sort of can root down to like kind of just being in the right place at the right time. And sure, like they made a lot of good decisions, but they didn't make those decisions any more wisely than other people that had made decisions that went wrong. And
yeah,
pretty funny. Ah, well, that was a pretty nice thing to end on. So what a really good interview. Oren is a bit of a badass. I'm really happy that we got the chance to speak. He certainly has his own view on the world and is pretty strong on his values and doesn't take any crap from anyone, which is quite refreshing and nice. So in terms of my top take-homes, I really like this point about neediness killing deals. And yeah, if you turn up and you are really just trying to do whatever you can to get the person's money, and it just is, it's kind of obvious, and it just ends up leading to you having quite a bad situation that isn't really what you wanted. And in anything in life, when you're just needy about things, it just makes everything worse. So if you can be much stronger on your values and really stick to who you are and be like an actual person that's very much like, this is me, I stand for what I do, like it's very easy for people to work with you and do the right things that you want them to do rather than doing the things that they might want you to do but maybe aren't even. So I also have explained this terribly, but essentially just don't be needy and have good values, and that's the most important point. Secondly, his growth mindset attitude of just doing stuff. Like, yes, there are great books and lessons and everything, but they don't ever do the work for you. The only way that you really, really learn the essence of something is by doing it. So you can read a book at the time that you're doing it. It might motivate you to do more, and it might make you realize the thing that you're making the mistake at a time that you're doing it, so you can then go back and do the same thing again better. But just reading will never get you anywhere in life. You actually have to go and like do the hard things yourself and just learn through experience. That is a huge point. And then lastly, I really liked his tip to me, personal tip. It was good. I'm glad I asked that. Which was that most people who are hugely successful do get there through kind of luck. And sure, you do have to work hard and just keep on moving forwards. But if you constantly have expectations about things, it's just not useful for you, and you just need to remember that you need to be in the right place at the right time somewhere and not get pissed off when things don't go your way. And also, I really like this point about showing that you are an expert rather than telling, because just talking about stuff is meaningless and you really need to like actually prove by doing stuff. So yeah, it's a big one. And related to his point on kindness and things, you can talk about however kind you want to be. At the end of the day, it doesn't make you a kind person. So show that you're a kind person by being kinder. And I've been trying to do that, which doesn't show you anything. So maybe not the best example. I guess I could mention that although I haven't given anyone the 10 grand check like this person, like Oren had, I have given a friend £16,000 to get him out of credit card debt this year. I say give, loaned him, but still pretty nice. It's a bit of a risk for someone like me who doesn't have £16,000 lying around. So I think that was pretty kind of me. So yeah, I think I'm showing up for people when they need something. Hopefully you can too. And now moving on to books. Well, obviously we only really spoke about Oren's books, Pitch Anything, which is pretty good, and Flip the Script, which seems to be actually a genuinely useful read for sales. But as Oren says himself, books are kind of meaningless without doing it. So if you're actually trying to do sales and are going to actually put these lessons into practice, great. If you're just sitting at home and want to improve your sales by doing nothing, then this isn't the book for you, apparently. So there we go. Great podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. And tune in again next week. Or don't, because you're too busy selling things. Who knows? All right. Ciao.
If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love to feel your support on Patreon, where you can legally just send me money. Now, if you're listening, you probably have this really deep problem inside of you where you just have too much money and maybe you don't have enough of a growth mindset in your life. So Patreon exists to balance this disparity in your life, and you can achieve inner calm by sending me your money. But on a more serious note, I'll also maybe give you some life coaching, and that'd be kind of fun because I like talking to people. And you'll also get free copies of all of my books as and when I publish them, which may take a while, but they will definitely be free for any of my supporters because why not? I like being supported. So that would be nice. And yeah, enjoy your week. I will be back next week to talk about how I nearly killed myself. And yes, that will be fun. So see you next week. I should just add that it was an accident, and this is not a suicide podcast or anything weird. This is definitely the Growth Mindset podcast, and we'll be talking about the ways that I grew my mindset by nearly killing myself in an accident. And yes, it's quite interesting, actually. Turns out nearly dying is quite liberating in many ways. And anyway, I'll dig into that next week. Bye.
You've just listened to an episode of the Growth Mindset podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your preferred app and give me a good rating, as these go a really long way. If you are unable to give good feedback right now, try sharing the show with a friend who will, or just wait for the show to improve. If you have any ideas for the show or you just want to chat, then please reach out to me on Twitter at SamHarrisTweets or Instagram at SamJamSnaps. Show notes and other links to topics discussed in the episodes are available at the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com. Thanks so much for listening. Give yourself a big hug from me. If you're with a friend, give them a hug as well. And I hope you enjoy your next podcast.